Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I am delighted to talk again to Professor Overmyr Anjum. You are most welcome, sir.
Thank you very much for having me.
Overmyr, for those who don't know, is Imam Khatib Endowed Chair of Islamic Studies at the University of Toledo in the United States, and he obtained his PhD in Islamic History. And he's the author of this book entitled Politics, Law, and Community in Islamic Thought, The Timaean Moment, and it's published by Cambridge University Press. And I do highly recommend this book. Today, Overmyr has kindly agreed to discuss the contentious issue of rebellion in Islam. Does the Islamic tradition require Muslims to give virtually unconditional obedience to even the most tyrannical of rulers, or is armed rebellion permissible against a tyrant? What does Islam actually teach? So would you like to introduce us to this subject, sir?
Sure. My pleasure. Thank you very much, Paul, again, for having me and for your interest in this topic, which is really becoming crucial as authoritarian states take over throughout the world, particularly the Muslim world, and use religious clerics and religious traditions to serve their narrow interests. And in that effort, unfortunately, Islam is being conscripted, which is ironic and tragic because Islam has throughout history been a religion of justice. So let me start with this anecdote. You know, when I was an undergraduate, oh God, an embarrassingly long time ago, I had a professor at the University of Wisconsin, Madison, who would teach world religions, right? Mm. And the way he taught was he would take every religion and read deeply into its sources and come out with one thing that he thought the religion was about. Mm. So I remember when he would talk about Judaism, it was community. Mm-hmm. The central value of Judaism was community. Mm-hmm. When he would talk about Christianity, it was charity. And when it was Islam, he would say, this religion is all about justice. Oh. And it's not very hard to see why he would come to that conclusion. Mm. You read the Quran, you read the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. You look at his own career, his own conduct. You look at early Muslims. You look at Islamic law, and you find Islamic justice or justice to be such a crucial idea that pops up again and again in every field. And the very idea of law, right, it's so central to Islam, and law is about ultimately, you know, it's about justice, that mm-hmm. God cares about, not that you pray ritually to him, which is, of course, very important, but that God cares.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
You are just to his creatures. So it's ironic, therefore, that in over the course of the 20th century, in particular, some of the theological moves that have taken place in the wake of course, colonialism, and then after colonialism, the nominally free nation states, which are in some ways even more deeply colonized than the colonial Muslim world of the 19th century. A theology of domination, a theology that might is right kind of theology has emerged.
Right.
And at the center of that theology is the idea that I want to talk about today, which is that no matter how unjust and how tyrannical the ruler, Muslims, by their creed, by their aqidah, not merely as a matter of one possible opinion or prudence, but creedally bound never to rebel and always to obey, and in fact, not even protest peacefully, right? So this theology has gone to the point that it says that even peaceful public protest is against Islam. And that's what I want to talk about today.
Right. Excellent.
Taking you through all the sources that are recalled.
Good. Just what we need to go through. So thank you for this.
Okay, wonderful. So let me show you my slides, because that will help some of the complex materials that I can now just talk about. Islamic views and rebellion against unjust Muslim rulers. So each of these adjectives is important. This is, we're talking about unjust Muslim rulers, so not non-Muslim rulers and not just Muslim rulers.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's what I'm going to do briefly. I'm going to go over contemporary claims about rebellion being always prohibited as a matter of Sunni creed in particular, summary response to those claims, and then I will examine the hadith evidence The reason we will look at the Quran evidence, but we'll talk really about why there isn't any direct evidence for or against it in the Quran. We'll look at the hadith evidence and then the companions' views and the early imams of the first two centuries. When the word, when I use the word imams, Shia use the word imams in a more particular sense than the Sunnis do. And I will be talking primarily about the Sunni perspective. And from Sunni perspective, the imams are the scholars who are followed. They're not infallible, but they are followed by the vast majority of Muslims. And of course, the four schools of Islamic, of Sunni Islam come to mind, the four schools of jurisprudence. But I'm using the word more broadly as the leaders, including those four, but also ones that they followed as well, and ones that are generally referred to when we are talking about jurisprudential discussions. And then I will look at some major figures, such as Imam al-Juwayni and Ibn Taymiyyah and al-Mawardi, rahimahumullah ajma'in, in order to look at how this doctrine develops later in history. So first, let's start with contemporary claims about rebellion. I'm going to summarize those claims into these 6 points. First, that any rebellion of subjects, you know, of course, in the modern word would be citizens, but given how the modern world, the modern, particularly Arab world works, there is really no effective citizenship. So any rebellion of subjects or citizens against rulers is prohibited in Sunni Islam. This prohibition includes unjust, tyrannical Muslim rulers. This prohibition is part of the Aqidah or the agreed upon creed of Ahl Sunnah. This is a statement recently made by the American preacher Hamza Yusuf. Number four, the prohibition extends to unarmed protesters. For instance, in contemporary Egypt, not too long ago, unarmed protesters who were called dogs of hell, which is a term, of course, as it sounds, a condemnation, but also as a particular reference to a very deeply feared and hated sect in early Islam called the Kharijites. And fatwas were given to shoot to kill them in hundreds and thousands if necessary. Over 1,000 people were killed at Rab'a with the blessing of some of these clerics, Ali Jumu'ah being the most prominent one. In UAE and the Wahhabi Saudi establishment, that is these Gulf states, it has been a long-standing orthodoxy, if you will, of the 20th century that advice to rulers can only be given in private, otherwise it causes dissension. So do not publicly protest injustice and do not talk to rulers in a way that might put them off, might displease them. Rulers must always be pleased, even when you're disagreeing with them. So do so in private and very politely. Also, one thing that, and this advice has been given in a very politically public way to defend UAE's normalization with Israel and whatnot by Sheikh bin Baya, who is a Mauritanian cleric working for and within United Arab Emirates these days. And finally, the sixth point I want to make is that it was the Saudi Wahhabi establishment that was the 20th century pioneers of this never rebel, never question views as being the only acceptable orthodoxy. But even there is a shift even in that over the course of the 20th century, because pre-1990s, this idea, never rebel, was based on a religious mission, the religious Wahhabi mission to protect monotheism. So in other words, it wasn't that you're protecting the rulers, but rather you are,
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Accepting the rulers for who they are, even if they're imperfect, because they're protecting religion. Mm. But in the recent incarnation of this with Bin Baya and company, in fact, you are protecting a secular state. You're protecting just the ruler and his family, regardless of their religious credentials, which you don't question and which are not brought forth at all. So in other words, this doctrine has become secularized in the late 20th and early 21st century, rather. So these are the claims that I will be talking about today. My summary rebuttal of these extreme statist claims, I'm calling them statist claims, and this is deliberate because they're often seen by people, by well-meaning students of Islamic history, as quietist claims. But in fact, there is nothing quietist about them. They're very politically activist. They are, in fact, supporting political action on the part of the state in order to suppress a regime, dissidents, and in fact, start wars all over the world and support wars. So they're very politically activist. But rather, they're the crucial thing about them is that they are statist extremism. Meaning that the state is ultimately entirely unquestioned authority. It says it is the authority of Islam. And because there are many states, effectively what you have is all of these states that are claiming the authority of Islam, you must submit to them as a matter of religious creed. Now, I will claim that there is no precedence in Islam for this extremist statism, or even its more moderate, for its more moderate versions, there is a disagreement. So you could never say that this is part of the Aqidah, part of the Sunni creed. But when it comes to this extreme statism, there is no precedence for it. In fact, it goes against everything that we know from the Quran and the Sunnah and from the Islamic tradition. In the tradition, we will show that the prohibition against rebellion is not general, but limited in the very hadith reports that are cited, which we'll discuss below. It's limited to Muslim rulers who establishes prayers and all pillars of religion and does not commit clear unbelief. But also, there is some ambiguity there of whether, what does it mean to establish all pillars of religion? Does this mean establishing the Book of Allah, which includes justice, and so on? So there has been a very deep and healthy discussion and disagreement among Muslim jurists throughout on this question, which we'll talk about briefly. If the ruler is deemed to be just and upholds Islam, rebellion is prohibited by consensus, which of course, those who are rebelling may think that this is unjust, but it should be, and therefore that's how they justify their rebellion. And there are in fact very strict laws for that, of how people like that could be dealt with by a just imam. A just imam who is confronting rebels who are mistaken, in fact, still has a lot of responsibilities toward them that you will find in books of Islamic jurisprudence under chapters of Ahkam al-Bughat, or how to deal with rebels. So in other words, the idea that even if you are a just ruler and the rebels are entirely unjustified, you do not open fire at them and don't shoot to kill, right? Finally, in Islamic tradition, if the ruler is tyrannical, there are three opinions on the rebellion, on rebellion against such a tyrannical ruler. One, it is permissible, and some would say even an obligation. This is an opinion that is that can be derived from the actions of some of the companions, many of the companions rather, but also some of the classical scholars. We'll talk about Imam al-Juwayni in this regard. Number two, it is permissible if ruler can be unseated without more bloodshed than what the ruler is causing. So in other words, there is a weighing of benefit and harm, and feasibility, as well as benefit, and if you will, Muslim jurists taking their cue from the Quran and the Sunnah always want to minimize bloodshed. If that means tolerating a moderately bad ruler, for instance, so long as they're doing largely good, do so. So that's the spirit of the school. Now, this is Abu Hanifa's school. What I will argue is that Imam Abu Hanifa's own opinion, rahimahullah, is closer to the first one. We'll also we'll talk about those details a little bit later. Finally, the third opinion is that it is impermissible. And that's the opinion that we have, that we know today as the only possible opinion. But in fact, it is a relatively late opinion. And even those great imams who have defended this opinion, like Ibn Taymiyyah, they clearly, explicitly state that this is not always and not the only opinion. And some of the great Salaf and the Sahaba had the other opinions.
Right. Okay. So,
on the Quran, as I said, there is no direct evidence in the Quran, but generally a proactive attitude toward the use of force for justice. Quran is talking in a society where there is no established central authority. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam is the one establishing that authority. But nevertheless, when issues like great injustice are mentioned, when one group unjustly attacks the other, here is the Quranic guidance in Surah Al-Hujurat. And if two factions among the believers should fight, then make peace between them. The word iqtatalu is not just necessarily, you know, hand-to-hand combat, or rather this isn't necessarily just a fight, but one that involves arms and killing. But if one of them oppresses the other, then fight against the one that oppresses until it returns to the ordinance of Allah. So the word oppression here, which is a translation of the word rebellion, here the Quran is saying that you should assess which of the groups of Muslims that are fighting is just. And so the key word is justice and oppression. When you go against justice, you become an oppressor. And the Quran doesn't say, well, sit and wait. The Quran doesn't say, be quiet. The Quran doesn't say, pray to God, pray to me to see, you know, what to do. But the Quran says, join the one that is just against the one that is rebelling and transgressing. But of course, start by first trying to make peace between them. So peace is always a priority. But of course, in real life, doesn't always happen. So if the fighting and oppression continues, then you join the one that is fighting for justice. And then until it returns to the ordinance, to the hukum or of Allah, to the command of Allah. And if it returns, then make peace between them in justice and act justly. Two words for justice, adil and qist. And Allah loves those who act justly. So this is, there are some other verses in the Quran, but effectively this is the ethos of the Quran. Justice is very important in that you need to sometimes use arms to secure it. Now, to the hadith reports, which are much more numerous and much more complex on this question. So what I have done here is I have listed all the major authentic reports. There are many inauthentic reports on these questions, precisely because they were politically so weighty that people who were trying to please the ruler or the leader on their side tended to fabricate reports. That's why it's very important that each of these reports, that we don't employ those reports that sort of derail our discussions because they enter into politically charged rulings. These are all traditions that Sunni scholars.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Except they're found in main Sunni traditional corpus, and mostly in Bukhari and Muslim, and some in the Musnad of Ahmed. But I will not go into those details. What I have given here is given the Arabic, a little bit of Arabic, which in Arabic is called taraf, a part of the hadith which you can use to search and find the original. So here are the hadith. In Islamic hadith science, as I'm sure you know, hadith is typically known by the sahabi or the companion who narrated the hadith. So I have given on the left the companion who narrates the hadith. There may be other down the chain, many other narrators from that sahabi, but that's how the hadith is recognized. In the left list, you will find the hadith that are against rebellion or that appear to be against rebellion. And the gist of those hadith is, do not rebel if the ruler continues to establish prayers. In another narration, do not rebel until you see in the ruler's in conduct clear unbelief. And another narration, do not ever be pleased with an oppressive ruler. Do not support them, but do not take up arms against them if they pray and fast. So here, this is the prayer. Fasting is included, meaning that this isn't, it's not just about the prayer, but rather what is being referred to is something else, meaning that they are establishing prayer and fasting. They're establishing the religion of Allah. And then in the second line, the hadith of Ubadah ibn Samit, radiallahu anhu, you'll find that a relatively high, this is the highest bar that's given, which is that until they commit clear unbelief. So you could say that establishing prayer is one bar and clear unbelief is another bar. And, you know, we could talk about that. And there in the next hadith, in Anas ibn Malik's hadith, which is both in Bukhari and Muslim, ما أقام فيكم كتاب الله, obey your imam, even an Abyssinian slave, which was seen, this was seen, Abyssinian slaves were seen as slaves. They were brought into Mecca as outsiders. And the Meccans would consider outsiders as the least likely to become, or Meccans and Medinans would see outsiders as the least likely candidate for leadership. The Prophet is saying, even such a person, an outsider, comes so long as they're ruling by the Book of Allah, accept them. Ibn Abbas, his narration says, whoever, if you hate something from your commander, be patient. And the reason commander is important is because sometimes the Prophet is simply giving out instructions to groups that he's dispatching for particular tasks, and he calls one of them their commander. And he says, look, if your commander, who is going out to do some recon work or something, if he does something that you don't like, don't start fighting with each other. So it's a very sort of practical, pragmatic command. So these are the five main hadith wordings that appear in favor of what we may call quietism. And then there's a sixth one, the hadith of Hudhayfah ibn Yaman, radiallahu anhu, which is sort of a curveball, as I will say, because it says something very strong, which is that obey your ruler, وَإِن ضَرَبَ ظَهْرَكَ وَأَخَذَ مَالَكَ, even if he beats your back and takes your wealth. So all of a sudden, as you will see, especially when we look at the hadith on the right side, this hadith seems to be a kind of obsequious submission that is completely off the rest of the traditions and seemingly against it, but we'll talk about that later. Now look at the hadith on the right-hand side. All of the hadith are in authentic compilations that seem to suggest a positive attitude toward rebellion, or at least the use of force in correcting what has gone wrong. So Ibn Mas'ud, Abdullah ibn Mas'ud's narration, no obedience to anyone who disobeys Allah. Ibn Umar has a similar hadith, no obedience. Now, la sam'a wa la ta'a, no listening and no obedience, is a phrase that is used not merely as in, you know, I am your servant, but I will, you know, respectfully disagree with this particular command, but rather when you say la sam'a wa la ta'a means I have no, you have no authority over me.
Right.
Now, this is something that can be disputed. It's a matter of interpretation, but often this is how the Arabs use the word, which means that if the ruler is disobeying God, then their political authority can be challenged. At least this is one interpretation of this hadith. Similarly, the hadith of Abu Sa'id al-Khudri, whoever sees an evil, change it by force or by tongue or by heart, and doing just by heart is the least of faith you can have. Beyond this, there is no faith. The hadith of Jabir ibn Abdullah and Tariq ibn Shihab and many other narrations, this is a very important hadith that the greatest jihad or martyrdom is that you command and forbid an oppressive ruler in front of him publicly and are killed as a result. There are many narrations of this hadith from different narrations, different companions, which means the Prophet would repeat this. So the highest form of jihad, highest form of martyrdom, is to speak truth to power. Do so publicly. Ubadat ibn Samit hadith that says, La ta'ata liman asa Allah, similarly the theme that has gone above. And then the very important hadith of Abu Bakr, which is that when people see an oppressor and do not do anything to stop him, then God will punish them all with the oppression. The hadith of Ibn Mas'ud, when you see an oppressive authority, oppressive ruler, and you do not take force, fight against them, right? Or rather, the wording goes this way, then whoever does something with their hands, meaning fights them, is a believer. Whoever speaks out against them is a believer. Whoever feels repulsion in their heart because they're not able to do anything else is a believer, but beyond that, there is no faith. Finally, another hadith of Abdullah ibn Amr, whoever dies fighting to protect their wealth or their property is a martyr. So a very commonsensical thing that you have to protect what you have, as opposed to, of course, the hadith that seems like, you know, your ruler can beat you and take your wealth and you're not supposed to react. So this is the big picture of the hadith traditions. Here I summarize them. The pro-rebellion, pro-quietism hadith on the left that suggest if the rulers are tyrannical, never be pleased with them, nor follow them, right? So never join them, but do not take up arms against them. So long as is, it becomes tricky because some hadiths say, so long as they're just praying, which means the bar couldn't be very high, or praying and fasting and doing all the religious things, the main pillars of religion, which is bar is a little high, do not exhibit clear unbelief. This is perhaps the lowest bar, which is that so long as they're not...
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
You know, actively committing unbelief. And then there is another version of the narration which places the bar high, which is obey even an outside ruler so long as they establish the Book of Allah. So this is a high bar, right? This is that not just that they're not unbelievers, but that they're in fact establishing the Book of Allah. Now, all of these different type of hadith, what they do is it is the scholars who have to judge which of these is really meant and when is the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam simply using a simple language to explain to people what is meant. So does establishing prayer meaning establishing the Book of Allah, or perhaps all it means is not being clearly a non-Muslim. So all of these are up for discussion, which is why, and this is not uncommon in hadith tradition. Anybody who does fiqh or does jurisprudence knows that scholars then have the burden to reconcile what seems like differing opinions. Mm-hmm. On the right-hand side, as I said, you seem to have much more activist hadith, which require removing of evil and fighting injustice actively. Okay, now in this list here, on the left-hand side, what I'm calling a curveball, which is an American phrase for something that you don't expect, which is obey the ruler, even if he beats you your back and takes your wealth. What do you do with this hadith? I have done a little bit of research on that hadith. There are three main narrations of the hadith. And when you look at the context of the hadith, in fact, it becomes clear that the Prophet ﷺ is talking about, he's talking about an extreme kind of emergency situation. So where Hudhayfa ibn al-Yaman radiallahu anhu is asking the Prophet about what is going to happen in future, the end times, the worst times that are going to happen. So the Prophet said, this will happen. Then what, to the Hudhayfa says, what should I do? Or this happens, then what should I do? And then when having exhausted all other options that you couldn't fight such a bad ruler, things have gone really bad, it's nearly end times, then you find one ruler who may not be the kindest and the most fair, but who is upholding God's rule, God's norms. Then the Prophet said, join such a ruler, even if he beats your back and take your wealth. Right. So it is in that kind of emergency situation, those kinds of exceptional circumstances, that almost end times apocalyptic tradition in which the next step after that is the Antichrist appears.
Gosh.
So that's why I don't think that this hadith is I don't question the authenticity of the hadith because I've studied it. And, this will be an entirely different a lecture just on that hadith and its various narrations. But this hadith is about emergency situations when you find that end times are near. Now, let's look at, which is what all jurisprudential schools do in one way or another, when they find that there is a complex set of commands by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, you look at the conduct of the companions, of how they understood those commands. Well, here's what we find. For Abu Bakr's first sermon, he says, radiallahu anhu, obey me if I obey God, not otherwise. So if he is disobeying God, he leaves quite a wide leeway in what people could do. In the case of Umar, there are anecdotes such as what Umar would say, what would I do if I went astray? Not that I left Islam, but I went astray as in I was no longer just, I was no longer fair toward you. And in one case, the response is, we will take up arms and straighten you up. And Umar praises God for giving him followers, Muslims, who will correct him if he went astray. Uthman, radiallahu anh, who is surrounded for weeks by rebels, never uses these traditions to say that you guys have all become unbelievers and that the Prophet said, never question anything. Rather, Uthman spent a long time explaining where his policies were either misunderstood or what he would correct all of this stuff is, you know, found in Hadith literature and in Tariq literature. Tariq is history. So in historical literature and Hadith literature, all of this is well established. Ali ibn Abi Talib, radiallahu an, the fourth caliph, is the most important and relevant figure in this case because it is in his time that most rebellions took place. He never cites any of these traditions against any of the rebels. Let's look at the first civil war when Ali is fighting Talha, Zubair, and Aisha, radiallahu anhum.
So can I just clarify, sorry to jump in there in your lecture, but you say Ali never cites these traditions against any of the rebels. The question naturally arises, why didn't he cite these? If these traditions are authentic traditions of the Prophet and they are clearly pertinent, well, they might well be pertinent, why apparently did he not cite them? I don't understand.
Yes, but if you could hold that question until the end, because there is going to be... We're going to have to, frankly, address that question head on and think about that.
Okay.
Right? Because it's not just Ali's conduct. You look at this this Ma'rikat al-Siffin, or rather Jamal, the first one, and Talha Zubayr Aisha. These are all old friends and relatives who end up fighting. In this case, most companions side with Ali, many side with Talha, Zubayr, and Aisha, and once they are defeated, then the Siffin comes when a much bigger combat against Muawiyah. A minority sides with Muawiyah, majority sides with Ali, and an important small minority stays neutral. I shouldn't say how small. There is some studies recently that shows that majority of the Sahaba sided with Ali, but how small is the minority that stayed neutral? I haven't seen a good study. Nevertheless, these people, the Sahaba.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise. Having fun in the sun or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Such as Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas and Ibn Umar and a number of important companions stayed neutral. Right, and it is their opinion, the staying neutral, that becomes, of course, for later Sunnis, this becomes the probative opinion, the only opinion. But early Sunnis understood that this was just one of those various options. But here is the great surprise. To the extent that we have an idea of what these people were saying to each other and how they were arguing with each other, no one reports citing any prohibition by the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, says that, look, you know, the Prophet said, once you have an imam, do not rebel.
Yeah.
Right? Similarly, in the next case, 2-3 decades later, we have the first, the civil war of Al-Husayn, the second civil war, rather, of Al-Husayn, rebelling against Yazid in the 60s and... in the 60s of Hijra. And then Abdullah ibn Zubayr rebelling against Yazid. Many companions that were alive at this time, Ibn Umar, Ibn Abbas, Abdullah ibn Zubayr, of course, he himself rebelled, and Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiya, a tabi'i, not a companion. But nevertheless, a number of these people are trying to dissuade al-Husayn from leaving Mecca to go to Kufa, right? against a sitting imam, against a sitting leader, Yazid, none of them cites these hadith. None of them says, look, your grandfather, O Hussein, radiallahu anh, your grandfather said, never rebel against a ruler. None of them says that. All of them use prudential reasons that these people in Kufa are not reliable. Don't go to them. They will betray you. I mean, would al-Hussein have dismissed his grandfather's clear, agreed upon, well-known command? Now, later and younger companions begin to cite reports on both sides after the Second Civil War. So as shown, I have, in this, if you look at the people who are citing Auf ibn Malik, Ubad ibn Samit ibn Salama, Anas ibn Malik, Ibn Abbas, these are all, in fact, not even Ibn Abbas, but all of these are relatively companions who lived long and were relatively less important compared to the, of course, the first generation, the senior companions, right? So this is what, if you will, adds to the wonder, why are they not citing the hadith of the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, right? In key moments. And now this is not something that we can necessarily resolve, but I think that we could speculate. And I think that my understanding as a historian who works in the first century is as well, that is, I look at later periods as well, but I recently completed a book on first century, which hasn't been published yet. My understanding is that none of them understood the prohibition of the Prophet ﷺ to apply to a blanket prohibition of rebellion against the ruler. They understood the Prophet's command to be about, first of all, the Khawarij, the rebels who began fighting Muslims and killing Muslims, innocent Muslims. And also they understood those to be applicable in part to if a ruler becomes a clear enemy of Islam, if they abandon the sunnah of the Prophet such that Islam is being disfigured, then those prohibitions did not apply. So those prohibitions applied to things like the ruler begins to drink alcohol, because this was a very common disease among rulers at the time, and starts to enjoy personal luxuries which go far beyond what Islamic law prohibits. But you have the ruler at the same time is applying Islamic law in all parts of, you know, in upholding, living by Islam, protecting the borders of Islam. Now, taking up arms against them just for personal deficiencies might lead to more bloodshed. Whereas when the ruler begins to work against the interest of Islam, against the Book of Allah, in such a way that people move away from religion, which was al-Hussein's analysis, right? Al-Hussein would think that what Yazid is doing, even though Yazid was a Muslim, Yazid had led even earlier, had led jihad, in fact, in earlier, he was a Muslim, but a Muslim whose interests were systematically going against the true understanding of Islam that al-Hussein and the people in Medina in general had. So, when they thought, so what the Prophet was talking about was, don't take these personal personal sins as an excuse just to rebel against, because now the Prophet is talking to a people who are not used to central government. They're not used to government at all. They are people who take pride in, they write poetry about their freedom, about their anarchy. And the Prophet knew that many of these people are going to rebel. This is exactly what happened in the time of Abu Bakr, right? Half of Arabia rebelled against central authority, not in any kind of principled reason, but because they didn't want taxation or they didn't want the primacy of Medina over them. So anyway, this is my interpretation, but we can move on back to our topic of how did the great Muslim imams, whom all Sunnis see as their authority, how did they understand this? So look at the first century, the major rebellion the first century. I guess I should say something about late first century. There are three main centers of Islamic scholarship of the great leaders, where companions as well as their main students and leaders are situated. There is Iraq, there is Medina, and there is Syria. Iraq, the center of Iraq, Kufa, is one of the most important and the largest cities in the Islamic world. And then you have Medina, which is, of course, important because of the legacy of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, the family of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, and of the main companions. And then Syria, which is where the Umayyads, the actual power, is situated, Damascus. Now, most jurists and hadith scholars of Kufa and many of Medina, including leaders of Sunnis that today we cite as evidence when taking this or that jurisprudential opinion, they supported the rebellion of people like Ibn al-Ash'ath against al-Hajjaj. Hajjaj is no doubt established a governor of Abd al-Malik ibn Marwan, the Marwanid Umayyad leader, and Abdurrahman ibn al-Ash'ath rebels against him, and many of the scholars of Kufa join that rebellion. In some reports, it is said, somewhat exaggeration, that none of the scholars remained behind. Mm-hmm. None of the Qurra remained behind. Now, of course, you know, this was perhaps political propaganda, but then nevertheless, we know many important scholars rebelled. Now, Hajjaj had not committed kufr. He was not an unbeliever, and he had not stopped praying. We know that for a fact. Mm-hmm. Many of the imams of Ahl al-Bayt, of course, rebelled. But Abdullah, son of Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, the great caliph, joined some of those rebellions. None of these people thought that the Prophet had a blanket prohibition against rebellion. Now, these rulers that they're rebelling against are, in fact, much more legitimate in many ways. They are much more Islamic. They are, in fact, protecting the borders of the Muslim world and upholding the Sharia. Not only that, people like the Marwanids are, in fact, Islamicizing the bureaucracy. So they are far more Islamic than any rulers today, certainly, and even throughout history, arguably. So my point is that this, in the second century, when Islamic tradition sort of comes together and the great imams, this is when the great imams emerge, most people seem to be okay with rebellion. Mm-hmm. Imam Ibn Hazm, a 5th century prodigy, one of the greatest independent scholars, says, the Ummah is agreed on the obligation of commanding right and forbidding wrong without any exception. Some of Ahl Sunnah, all of the Mu'tazilites, Kharijites, and Zaydi Shia agree that taking up arms for this purpose is an obligation if evil cannot be prevented without it. Imam Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani, and for those of you familiar with Islamic tradition, Ibn Hajar is a very important reference here because you cannot accuse him of being too early or being influenced by just early stuff. He is, in fact, the cornerstone of late Sunni orthodoxy. He is the great commentator on the Bukhari, As-Sahih of al-Bukhari, Fath al-Bari. He says, some rebelled in their zeal for the religion due to the tyranny of the rulers, not their unbelief, but the tyranny of the rulers and their abandoning of the prophetic sunnah, not unbelief, once again. And they were on the right. Included among these is al-Husayn and the Medinans, the people of Medina on the occasion of al-Harra, who rebelled against Yazid, the Quran reciters of Kufa, who rebelled against al-Hajjaj, the in the 82 rebellion of Abdurrahman ibn Ash'ath. Others rebelled for power, and such are properly called rebels. And elsewhere, he notes that rebellion against tyrants was the opinion of the earliest predecessors. That is legitimacy of rebellion, right? And these are the Arabic quotes that I have for what I have just cited. Abu Hanifa, he supported, so he's born around AD 82 and dies in the year 150. He sees these great transformations in his lifetime. He supported rebellion both against the Umayyads, that is the great rebellion of Zayd ibn Ali, against Hisham ibn Abd al-Malik in the year 122, and against Abbasids, the rebellion of Nafs al-Zakiyyah, the famous rebellion in 145 of Nafs al-Zakiyyah and his brother, Nafs al-Zakiyyah being in the Hijaz and his brother Ibrahim, Ibrahim being in Iraq. They both simultaneously rebelled, and Abu Hanifa supported both of them. Now, what's interesting is that rebellion for him is not only permissible, and he did not call any of them kafir. None of them were unbelievers, and none of them stopped praying. Hisham, in fact, is known personally to be a pious caliph. Now later Hanafis add the condition that, you know, Abu Hanifa is really supporting rebellion if they are feasible, right? But of course, this is reading into what might happen into future, whether the rebellion is going to succeed or not. But none of the two rebellions that Abu Hanifa rahimahullah supported, they succeeded. Both of them seemed unfeasible. In fact, there are some reports that suggest that he knew they're unfeasible. But he supported them financially and didn't personally join. He was an old man at the time, but he would support some of his disciples to go and join, and he would financially support them. Malik, rahimahullah, again, nobody needs to second guess Malik's authority in the knowledge of tradition. His opinion was, again, the original quote by Al-Qadi ibn al-Arabi, who was quoting the opinion, the Maliki opinion, is that one must support the just leader, be he the sitting ruler or the one revolting against an oppressor. So what matters is justice and not whether you have the power.
Right.
And he also went one step ahead and said, any pledge of allegiance for the ruler that is based on fear and coercion is not valid. Now, of course, these days, it's not fashionable in later Islam to even believe in any kind of pledge or allegiance or election. God forbid that's democracy. But in reality, for early Muslims, consent of the ruled was seen as necessary. And if the consent was forced, meaning it wasn't true consent, then any such pledge is not valid. And Malik, in fact, was physically beaten for giving this fatwa by the Abbasids, but he did not renege from it.
Wow.
Shafi'i, in his earlier Iraqi school, endorsed the Iraqi pro-rebellion opinion, and some reports have him join a rebellion against Harun al-Rashid in 180s in Yemen. That is year 180 of Hijrah and after. But these reports, in other words, Shafi'i then would be the only imam of the four who actually joined a rebellion. But these reports are too obscure and contradictory to make a solid case. What we do know is that in his earlier actual jurisprudential opinion in Iraq, he took a pro-rebellion position. Even Ahmad ibn Hanbal, and this is something that would be a shock to most people who see Ahmad ibn Hanbal as the most anti-rebellion person, but in fact, there is a disagreement reported by Abu Ya'la and Ibn al-Jawzi on whether Ibn Hanbal tolerated rebellion. And he, in one report, seems to suggest that it was justified, not against an unbelieving ruler, but against the sitting Abbasids, Al-Ma'mun and his predecessors, who were all believing Muslims, all prayed, and Islam was established in their time. Just to, I guess, really quickly go over how the opinion evolves. Al-Mawardi, now we are moving back two centuries later in early 5th century of Hijra. I'm sorry, I'm using Hijri centuries. So instead of thinking about, you know, common era, think about time since the Hijra of the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, right? Yep. So in early 5th century scholar, the leading Shafi'i, Ra'is, of the Shafi'is, and he was also the judge of judges, Qadi al-Qudat, in Baghdad. In his famous book, Al-Ahkam al-Sultaniyah, and elsewhere, there is a chapter on Ahkam al-Bughat, in which a number of conditions are given to declare any opponent of the ruler as a rebel that is legitimate to fight for the ruler. So here, these conditions are for the ruler, whether the ruler can go and fight and how can the ruler fight. And those conditions include that those rebels are armed. So unarmed protesters just do not count as rebels, bughat, at all. That not only are they armed, because people are generally armed at the time, they have gathered in one place and they have chosen a ruler, or chosen a leader to lead their rebellion. And on top of that, they have some reason, but that they're giving to challenge the ruler. Because if they don't have this and they're simply killing people, then they're bandits. But if they have a reason by which they're saying that the ruler is unjust and so on, then only can the ruler go and fight them and treat them as bughat. So it's not free for all for the ruler, that anybody who criticizes me, anybody who, you know, maybe they have gathered and maybe they have a movement going on, but if they haven't taken up arms, then they do not count as rebels. Al-Juwayni, who comes a generation after Al-Mawardi, or still 5th century of Hijra, Al-Juwayni says in his book Al-Ghiyathi, or Ghiyath al-Umam fil Diyath al-Dhulam, one of the most important and detailed books written on the subject. Al-Juwayni, of course, is a very important authority, the leading Ash'ari, the teacher of Imam al-Ghazali, whose opinion on this is the most developed opinion, because in his book Al-Ghiyathi, he imagines the possibility of rulers. The possibility of disappearance of the caliphate and what will happen later and so on and so forth. Al-Juwayni's opinion is that if a ruler becomes unjust, a Muslim ruler, a sitting Muslim ruler, not only unjust and begins to, so he's very clear that personal wickedness or personal sins of the ruler do not disqualify him. But let's say this is not personal, but rather public sins are so great that justice is impossible to uphold, that people find that the interest, that the ruler's interest and the ruling class's interests are systematically against the people. Of course, I'm translating in modern language. Then he says, not only should you rebel, but you should not hesitate from rebelling in fear of bloodshed, because the bloodshed the ruler is causing and the harm may be much greater. So Al-Juwayni is pro-rebellion. These are very qualified, much more developed conditions than we find in earlier literature. In other words, politically, it's much more mature. And finally, Ibn Taymiyyah, the scholars that I study and admire very much, he is very clearly against rebellion. But when he gives his anti-rebellion position, he is very clear that the early Salaf and many of the leaders, many of the Imams, the Sahaba, in fact, held a pro-rebellion opinion. So what is Ibn Taymiyyah's reason for being anti-rebellion? Well, it's really just his political analysis that it never works.
Mm.
Now, is he right on this? As a historian, I disagree. I live in a country, United States, which starts with a rebellion against the British. It is in many ways the most prosperous country in human history. So I don't necessarily take his historical analysis to be infallible, but he is very clear that, you know, the position that he's adopting is a position that can be disagreed with. And it's a position based on prudence, an analysis of circumstances that he had analyzed. Anyway, so this is all I have on the rebellion. There is a lot that could be said about how the jurisprudential opinion evolves, but I will not go into that. Happy to take any questions and thoughts.
Well, thank you very much for an extraordinary survey of the historical the data, the Quran, the Sunnah, the companions, and the founders of the schools, and right up to Ibn Taymiyyah. Absolutely fascinating. I still find myself a little bit confused, however, that the companions themselves, it would seem, had different opinions, if I've understood you correctly. There wasn't a uniformity of view. And that's quite disconcerting, emotionally, I suppose, one might say, because one would wish for uniformity of opinion or uniformity of view. But why did the opinion, the companions, do you think, if one can have an opinion about their views, why do they just seemingly have these divergent views, which mean that we're still perhaps today not absolutely certain which is the correct view for us all?
Yeah, so I think that in general, the companions agreed on a number of crucial issues, but did not agree on every issue. And in a sense, later that was seen by the scholars and the ummah as a mercy, because if companions all agreed on one thing, then we would not have a choice but to say this one thing, this must be the true and single and only opinion. But when companions disagreed, perhaps this was to some degree an evidence of the fact that, well, you know, they disagreed at the time of the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, on less crucial issues, and sometimes on crucial issues in which the Prophet would correct them. Whether, for example, the famous story where the Prophet says, don't pray Asr until you get to settlement of Banu Qurayza, and some companions prayed because it got late and they thought he was just trying to, make them hurry, and others thought, no, he actually literally meant don't pray, even if you miss the time of the prayer. So here you have a conflict between general command of praying on time and a specific command of not praying until you get there. And this conflict is resolved by the companions in different ways. And the Prophet, that's the most remarkable thing, the Prophet does not comment. He doesn't say who is right.
Yeah.
Sometimes leaving the Muslims to use their own moral judgment and intellectual understanding, of the tradition, that is in some ways the most important lesson of the Prophet, right? This is why our tradition of jurisprudence became such a rich and such an important tradition. It wasn't simply citing the things that it's not a recipe, in other words, right? Mm. It's guidelines often, and their general, sometimes the general goals are given, but you are to figure out the way to get there. So on this question, when the companions disagreed, of course, there is a question of why the first civil war happened, which is not our topic today. I'm happy to talk about it at a different time. But the point is that civil war happened, in which the companions, at the end of the day, they dealt with the civil war without excommunicating each other.
Right.
So I think that lesson, and the center of that lesson is Ali ibn Abi Talib, right? The hero, if you will, of the moment is the fourth caliph, Ali ibn Abi Talib, who is in the worldly politics, he loses the political battle. He wins militarily, but there is no peace in his time and so on and so forth. But when it came to the moral superiority and what Islam became, and I'm talking about Sunni Islam, it is his analysis and his conduct during these rebellions and during these turbulent times that became the center of Islamic jurisprudence. To give you an example, how you deal with the rebels and the different kinds of rebels, people only look at his conduct because we don't have anything direct from the Prophet or the first three caliphs, right? Only indirect evidence. So Ali radiallahu anhu was the one who, for instance, when he was dealing with the Kharijites, rebels who are left and right killing other Muslims, he dealt with them differently than when he dealt with Talha and Zubayr and Aisha radiallahu anhum, that he hated fighting them. And when he subdued them, he respectfully sent, you know, Aisha back to Medina, and he made up with the rest. Again, this is a conduct of what do you do when you are fighting other Muslims who is good, whose intention might be good and disagree with them. How do you deal with them? Similarly, on the occasion of the battle he had with Muawiyah at Siffin, he accepted to make peace and arbitration. Whereas other people, some extremists in his group, refused to do so. And that's when Kharijites are born.
Yeah.
The conduct of Ali radiallahu anhu on this case, arguing with the extremists, I mean, in some ways, it's really a very important part of Islamic jurisprudence. All that I do in my work as somebody who does political jurisprudence, political fiqh, if you will, it would be almost non-existent if it were not for the fact that first civil war happened and Ali was there to represent the Islamic opinion. And then the whole idea of there being disagreement among Muslims in which they do not simply excommunicate the others, as happened with the Christians and in other, in fact, you might argue with the Jews between the two North and South kingdoms. In Islam, this didn't happen. In Islam, the first fitna, or the civil war, ended with unity, not with complete, sort of dispersion of religion and end of political unity. In fact, in some ways, the best times materially and in terms of unity and civilization start when Hassan, radiallahu anhu, the elder son of Ali, hands power to Muawiyah in order to make peace. Well, you know, some people see that as a great tragedy. I see that as this is, you have a unique case in religious history when after such a deep division, you have the possibility of coming together through a sacrifice by grandson of the Prophet but a role model for how Muslims can behave in these circumstances without ending the religious community, right? Without complete division and sectarianism in which religion itself is lost. That doesn't happen.
No, I mean, thank you for that. But it strikes me, I mean, what one could say that we in an entirely new situation today, but by which I mean that the states that exist in the Middle East and elsewhere are not have developed a new power based on technology, on armory, on weapons, on the power of the state, its surveillance of citizens, its intrusion into the private realm, which I think is unprecedented in history, and the ability to do that and to control and survey populations through technology. And I mentioned the weaponry as well. Right. So doesn't it render this whole question of rebellion in Islam a moot point? In other words, it's kind of almost redundant because the state has such overwhelming power now to impose its will. And we saw this in the Arab uprisings, which were ruthlessly suppressed by force of arms. We not in a different era now where these questions no longer, but they have an entirely different kind of paradigm to work with? I mean,
so I would say both yes and no. I agree with you insofar as, of course, in the modern world, the political powers of surveillance and of large-scale organization have become unprecedented. This, by the way, Muslim scholars have recognized for over a century and done wonderful work over time to analysis. You know, sometimes when I'm talking to younger Muslims or people who are involved in Western discourses, they seem to be refer only to Western literature as if this is a new recognition. But in fact, you find this all the way to the end of the 19th century. People like Rashid Rida are talking about the power of large corporations and how that changes things. Mm-hmm. And you find this recognition among Muslims who have therefore been wrestling with this issue. Right. And I think it's really important that we include the great scholarship of the Muslim world of the 20th century in order to discuss these things. And what people say is that, yes, the new state is enormously powerful, but in some ways, the early Islamic model of Medina is much more relevant today than it was ever before in the medieval period. In many ways, the ability for people to be much more informed, for the majority of people to be involved in the process of governance and the process of sort of general social discussion of what should happen is possible today in a way that it never was. Mm-hmm. And is this cool? This is actually much more like the Medina of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, just at a much larger scale, than the medieval period, in which because of size, people simply had to depend on the metropolis, the caliphate center, to make those decisions for them, because you could not convey people's opinions on a number of issues. And people were just not literate. So in a sense, many things have become possible today that are in fact in harmony with the spirit of early Islam. On the other hand, so you're right that, look, rebelling against all the powers of the state are, it is difficult, but regime change and political change in the modern world is an extremely common occurrence.
Right.
It's not rare at all.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in some ways, it is much more common in, perhaps Western democracies are much more stable, but the rest of the world is not. And when I say they're stable for 50 years, right? This is not like 500 years that we're talking about.
Yeah.
So I would say that power change still happens. And the reason it happens, that's what political scientists study, something that I study as well, that rebellions usually take place when there is a split among the elite, when the elite join the people, some part of the elite joins the people. And that still happens. So I wouldn't say that this is all, we live in a different world where the older world has no wisdom for us. A third thing is that the possibility of rebellion, it indicates a profound sense of responsibility, an understanding of where political power comes from. Right. So it's not the actual act of rebellion, but the idea that the people have, in some cases, the right to rebel, that should change the way that the state rules or the power elite conceive of their rule. Right. In the case when you can never rebel, as the case with the Wahhabi state, and it's increasingly with the Wahhabi Saudi state being now becoming the norm for the rest of the Muslim world, the Arab world in particular, not actually, by the way, for non-Arab countries, but for the Arab countries, this idea that you cannot even protest peacefully, which is a monstrosity, I mean, moral monstrosity, to say that you cannot peacefully protest. This gives the ruler the idea that he is God, nearly, that when it comes to political decision-making, what happens is that people in the Gulf, like these rulers in the Gulf, they only have to think about what Washington is going to think, right? Because they think that the clerics in their system are going to control the people, and they're going to tell them that, look, if you rebel against the ruler, you're going to burn in hellfire forever. You don't want that, do you? So therefore, no matter what the ruler does, you effectively worship the state. And the attitude of worshiping the state, which is true in Egypt and Syria and elsewhere, the kind of attitude that is demanded of people, it's impossible for there to be a good government, an accountable government, a government that cares for the people or religion or more morality. You simply cannot have a government that has any sense of responsibility to the people if you think that your power is unquestionable in theory, and your clerical establishment. And Islam is a very strong power in Muslim societies, despite all the losses of Islamic institutions. Islam as an emotional fact is lived and felt in Muslim societies, perhaps more than it was, in fact, in the mid-20th century. And if that Islam is saying that the ruler is effectively unquestionable, that you cannot protest, then this is a formula for this kind of almost voluntary totalitarianism, right? And this is the best way that foreign powers can can use these rulers as puppets.
Yeah. It's very convenient, obviously, for Western foreign policy to have regimes or governments which are compliant in that way. It makes the world much more easier to manage, it seems, for the Western dominance of the geopolitical situation is obviously very significant. I think we might draw it to conclusion there. Thank you very much indeed for it. There's so many other questions one could raise, and I fear that we could go on forever. But I think for myself, certainly to ponder on much of this evidence, Abu Hanifa and Shafi and Maliki, his view is very, very interesting, and often not, at least in my experience, presented very publicly as factors to consider in this conversation about rebellion in Islam. So I'm immensely grateful to you, sir, for your time and your expertise and your knowledge. I'm very much looking forward also to see people talking about what you've said and discussing it and looking at the evidence and continuing the conversation, because it's such an important subject for all of us in the world today. So thank you very much indeed, sir, for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Until next time.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.